This Kenai conversation was recorded on Wednesday, September 4th. There may be dated references and encouragements to call in, both of which you should disregard. It is Wednesday, and it's time for the Kenai Conversation. I'm Jay Barrett. The wildfires that have plagued the Kenai Peninsula this summer continue, though the plague appears to be waning just a little bit. The Swan Lake Fire, the last time we met and talked about this this blaze, was still going great guns, and then it appeared to be ready to fade into obscurity, and then the north winds came and it blew up. So we're going to talk about the Swan Lake Fire again today. My guests are Brian Scott. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jay.
We have Andy Alexandru. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay.
And if I pressed all the right buttons, I've got Dan Nelson on the phone. Are you there, Dan?
I am. Good morning.
Oh, terrific. Dan Nelson from the Borough Office of Emergency Management. Dan's only here for about a half an hour. He's, you're heading down to the South Peninsula for a different kind of crisis situation. Quickly tell us about that, maybe.
So a little bit related, though. We've talked about the weather and the dryness that we've had, and then that dryness has also resulted in a few of our communities in the South Peninsula running low on water, as they have open water reservoirs. So going down there to assess that and start working on that situation as well.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Well, while we have you here, maybe we can start with you to talk about the Swan Lake Fire here, and maybe a little bit about how about a current status update as far as evacuations and roads and smoke and such from your office.
Of course. So good news came out yesterday after our long weekend and after kind of another wind event that we experienced on the fire, but we were able to kind of let up on the evacuation status. So Sterling is out of an evacuation status. That side of the fire looks real good. The team's been working hard. In Cooper Landing, they were at a set, so we used three levels, ready, set, and go. They were at set, and then get that getting ready to go stage. However, we were able to bring that back to ready as the risk has greatly diminished based on the work they've been doing. So all good things there for the residents of those communities. And as most folks on the peninsula know, if they've traveled here through here in the last few weeks on the Sterling Highway, we've had a traffic management plan with pilot cars at a few points and delays in there as those pilot cars were being used. Yesterday, we took those pilot cars out of the mix, so the road is open, although there is a bit of road construction. So those pilot cars are based on construction out there and not the fire.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. How, at its worst, over the last 3 weeks since the fire re-erupted, what was the worst traffic backup situation experienced out there?
You know, I think the worst was the night. It was a Monday evening that we went to a set, and that required us for safety as we had a very unpredictable fire, and we're seeing some different indications from our incident management team. And we had to close that road for, gosh, it must have been probably 4 or 5 hours. And so that resulted in quite a bad traffic backup. But for the most part, we found lines generally anywhere from 20 minutes to about 45, 50 minutes, maybe just a bit more than that on some occasions. So the weekends were a little bit heavier traffic, obviously, for us, but I think that closure was the worst.
Yeah, I want you to know I did my part, and I discouraged a group of friends of mine from coming down over the weekend. So.
Well, we do want people to come down, but we know it was a little bit of a difficult journey through that stretch of road for a while, and we definitely appreciated everybody's patience as we put safety first for both the public and the firefighters.
True, true. You know, I saw on your website that the it sort of touched on what you just mentioned. Kenai Peninsula still open for business.
Absolutely.
Despite.
Yeah, and that's an important thing. You know, everybody everybody has that perception of, we had smoke issues, we had those traffic issues, but, it's important to realize that we had those things, but our local businesses, our tourist-based businesses and others were still open and still ready to go. So we wanted to get that message out as well, that it's still a place to come down.
Have you got any preliminary figures yet as to what the monetary hit might be to the tourism industry?
I don't have those off the top of my head, and it might be a bit before we can get a handle on that if we can. But what we do know is that certainly this fire touched every piece of our economy here. Cooper Landing, especially with those seasonal businesses, certainly suffered by being socked in for smoke for so long. But we heard anecdotally that many places, all the way from Homer up to Cooper Landing and Seward, were affected. And I know again, anecdotally got reports over this Labor Day weekend that it was a fairly slow Labor Day weekend here on the peninsula.
Oh, sure. At your office, you and your office has been right out front covering all these things and providing information to residents on the peninsula. What feedback have you gotten from folks out there, citizens, about the situation and the response to it?
For the most part, the feedback has been good. There was definitely differing times. We've heard that of course the fire, as you mentioned in your introduction, was kind of at a monitor status. We weren't doing too much, and then of course with that windstorm it kicked up. And there's been definitely some feedback on why that was allowed to happen. And my only response to that is, and the fire team will get into this as well, is this year is, and we keep using this word, but it's true, it's completely unprecedented. And the fire behavior, the models that they use, all of the science that goes behind that, it just simply wasn't expecting this hot and this dry and to burn in areas where it hasn't burned before. So naturally, there's been some concern about those actions and how they were taken, where, if we were in a more average year weather-wise, that maybe would have come true, and those things would have been the most appropriate actions. So it's hard with hindsight being 2020, but there's definitely concern about that, and I understand why. This team here, our Type 1 Great Basin team, has just really done an excellent job. We really got a lot of positive feedback on the way they came in and started taking over that situation. That had certainly gotten bigger, and been able to get that to where it is today with the lifting evacuation levels. So I'll say overall the feedback has been positive, and there will certainly be a lot to talk about as we go through our after-action process on this fire as it gets calmed down.
Mm-hmm. So about 15, not quite 20 years ago, the borough took up Operation Firewise around the peninsula, and they talked a lot about defensible space around homes and the urban forest interface and such. And there was a lot of work done, a lot of money spent. Did we see the beneficial results of that work 20 years ago? Do you know?
I don't know if there's a direct correlation. Perhaps one of the folks from forestry might be better able to deal with that question. But I do know that a lot of the crews, especially up in the Cooper Landing area, have been helping those folks with some rather rapid landscaping. And I think it's a really good example of how, we see that threat coming. We know it's the right thing to do. It kind of encourages residents to do that. And it's still just so dry, and there's spruce bark beetle and other things that are in the mix now, and everybody that's living in those areas should absolutely consider Firewise in their property and having that defensible space to protect not only yourself and homes, but the firefighters responding as well.
Mm-hmm. Dan, let me turn to our other guests here, and maybe you can hold on, though I understand you do have to hop on a plane at 10:30, so just take off when you can or have to.
Sounds good. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Brian Scott, you're with the Great Basin Type 1 team. Is that right?
Yes, I'm affiliated with them for this incident. I'm actually just a single resource that's available nationwide to incidents such as this. When the incident management team arrives on scene, they do a rapid assessment of their needs for staffing levels that they don't physically come with, and then they place orders for those additional resources like myself.
How do I get a job like yours?
You show an interest, you talk with incident management teams, there's a lot of training. It's a national system of training that we all have to fulfill to get into this position in the first place, and then experience.
Man, I got to tell you, I told Andy this last time he and a couple other folks were here. The young lady was from Colorado. Yeah. The communications arm of Wildfire Incident Command is absolutely the best on earth. From a reporter's standpoint, you guys are incredible from top to bottom.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. In fact, you guys need to start holding seminars for every other branch of government. Well, tell me, what's it like to come in, as an individual resource out of the blue? You wind up in Soldotna, Sterling, and you gotta learn about this fire and talk about it. What's that experience like?
It's an absolutely fabulous experience. I'm from South Dakota. I'm working full time with the state of South Dakota Department of Agriculture. But it's a thrill for me to invest time that the state is allowing me to invest with incidents across the nation such as this. It's a thrill to come and make a difference in a community like this.
Wow. What impresses me is how much up to speed people have to get with these regular changeovers. Is that a challenge?
It can be a challenge. Of course, once an individual like myself gets the call that, hey, you're going to Soldotna, we try to research all we can of the history of the incident, look back, especially in the last week or so, so that as we're flying or driving or getting to the incident, we're already in the loop as far as what's happened, what's planning to happen. We get on NCWeb, which is a marvelous resource for getting information about incidents across the nation. We get on there, other resources. We talk to the staff that have ordered us to try to feel what our role will be when we get there. So when we hit the ground, we're pretty much ready to go.
Wow. Andy, what's it like for you having a bunch of folks coming in?
Oh, it's a good experience. We during the transition period, I make myself available to the team members, help them with local knowledge about where things are in the community, to find a dinner. Where the infrastructure is, the grocery stores, the clothing, things that help them outside of the fire realm, but add to their personal satisfaction for their days as they go by.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So where do we stand right now on the Swan Lake fire? Is that a question for you, Brian?
You bet. I'd be happy to. We are standing at 162,328 acres. We have met 29% of our objectives for this incident. We have a number of crews and resources totaling personnel in the amount of 719.
Mm-hmm. Recently, last month or so, I've heard these reports refer to percent of objectives achieved instead of percent of fire contained. Could you explain the difference in terminology and what they mean?
On different incidents, there's different levels of your goals for 100% containment. That would be a line, a solid line all the way around a fire. Other incidents don't have that 100% full containment, circling requirement. Some have a level where the fire will be allowed to do natural resource benefits in a certain part of the fire perimeter, and that's where we have concentrated more towards the term objectives.
Oh, okay. What are some of the major objectives on this fire then?
Well, the main objective and the first and foremost on every incident is firefighter and public safety. That's our overriding priority of the wildland fire management teams. Also, in addition, we want to have close coordination with and relationships with the public and our other stakeholders when we come in. We want to concentrate our efforts on the areas of management that will give us the highest probability of success, especially here concentrating on Sterling and Cooper Landing communities. We coordinate all of our activities with the Department of Transportation, has been a big player here, and their state troopers. To manage the traffic flow, because we certainly know that it's extremely important for the community and tourism to keep that Sterling Highway open as much as we can. So we've worked very hard with the cooperating agencies to do that. We want to also protect the ecological and wilderness values within the Kenai Refuge. That's a priority. We focus on protecting the government and private infrastructure in listing some. I see the Moose Research Center, the Kenai Refuge, as I mentioned, and then pipelines to the north and east of the fire, and then finally implementing suppression and repair in areas damaged by the suppression activity. So those are our main objectives.
Oh, okay. When I first asked that question and you paused, I thought you were going to say, well, Jay, the first objective is putting the fire out.
our first project is to public safety and firefighter safety. We mm-hmm. have to focus on that first and foremost and then move towards those other very important aspects.
Right. How, I know fire in general is dangerous. It's a dangerous thing, especially in, varied terrain with unpredictable winds. A couple weeks ago when the winds came up, how dangerous was that fire? How close did we come to, having the fire get all the way over the ridge into Cooper Landing and, up the river valley? Anybody? Andy?
Well, when that fire took off, that was, I believe, on the 17th, the weekend. Monday was, the 18th was Sunday. There was a lot of fire activity. It was dark. Things get to be almost at a panic level when you can't see what's going on. The Borough Office of Emergency Management indicated from a ready to a set evacuation notice, and that's just putting people in Cooper Landing on notice that, listen, things aren't going like we would like to see it going, and you need to be better prepared to leave. So it gets very confusing. You're in the smoke. You have some traffic impeded by the smoke. You can't see what you're doing. There's an awful lot of things going on all at once. It's very difficult to communicate between your division supervisors, the people on the ground, as to what's going on and what priorities they need to accommodate. And usually there are priorities that are ever-changing in a rapidly wind event fire that's being directed by Mother Nature and the wind.
Yeah. That Friday morning, which was the 16th, when I came in, National Weather Service had a fire weather warning out for high winds. They had initially forecasted for that afternoon, and then later in the morning they updated it to Saturday evening, which is when they showed up.
Yes.
How much preparation were you guys able to do between Friday morning when the weather service said there's going to be a bunch of wind and, you know, when it did blow up?
Yeah, I'm not too sure what occurred there. There was a Type 3 team in place. I was not employed at that moment. I didn't get on the scene until Monday, the 19th. Listening and looking at the Peninsula Borough blog, the KPBOEM.com is a wonderful source. That's what I was looking at on my phone to stay abreast as to what was going on. So you can see a problem coming. I do not know just exactly what the team members and the refuge and the Division of Forestry were considering at that time.
Yeah. Brian, did they share anything with you about how the fire blew up again?
Well, that was prior to my arriving.
Right.
But I'm looking at a progression map that shows on the 19th, just short of 25,000 acres burned. The 2 days prior to probably 8,000 acres or so. So that wind event definitely did have an effect. At that point, I believe the decisions were being made that, hey, we need some additional resources here, additional level of expertise and experience with the teams that can handle more folks, because we needed more folks.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any questions in the interim about why the firefighters seemed to be caught a little off guard with this wind event, since you had 2 days' notice that it was coming? You know, as far as ordering more, here's actually the nub of the question: does the fire actually have to be doing something for you to order more reinforcements, or can you preemptively order more resources? Or is that going to be a waste of resources in case you're not needed?
No, you can place an order for additional resources that you think are needed based on what your best guess on the upcoming weather and fire conditions are going to be. You definitely can.
Mm-hmm. And do we know if that was done at all between Friday?
I'm quite certain it was done.
Okay.
And that's what preempted a team mobilization. For a Type 1 team, you can't mobilize a team just overnight. It takes a couple days to get people together, arrange air travel, have the team members get together, and all the et ceteras that go along with it. So I'm quite certain that they were already thinking about mobilizing more resources, and those resources are human, as well as engines, helicopters, aerial resources, as in retardant aircraft, assembling them, getting them closer to the Kenai Peninsula, where they might have been out in the interior or up in Fairbanks. But we had as many as 11 aerial resources working this fire at one time.
Oh, wow.
Between the scoopers, between the fire bosses, and heavy air tankers.
Mm-hmm.
There was no less than 120, 130 gallons of water and or retardant delivered on that fire each day. The other thing that comes into play with the wind event, we can't fly. It's too dangerous. The aircraft do not, they're not aerobatic qualified, nor is the pilot, you know. So there's a lot of times where we can't do air support because of the weather conditions.
Mm-hmm. As I recall, you had just 20 firefighters still assigned to the job that day.
That was a short Type 3 team,
right,
in place, and a group of firefighters that were in an engine and associated with a helicopter coverage, too. We had a couple of light helicopters available, and they were directed to do some hot spotting, if you will. They see a smoke coming up in a sensitive area or something very close to the highway or the pipeline or the electric power lines. A cabin site, you know, we have several cabin sites. The refuge has some mechanical buildings in the area where the fire had burned through. So they were in place to take care of that. I don't really believed that managers were expecting the type of event that we did have that weekend. And how do you prepare for something that you're just not quite sure what the consequences will be because you don't know how big of a wind event you're really going to get?
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Say, Dan, do I still have you on the phone there?
I am here, yes.
Yeah, I know you probably got to take off real quickly here, but let me ask you, what was the things like in your office the weekend 3 weeks ago when the wind picked up?
So we did receive a call here from our from that Type 3 team, that incident manager team that was managing things and essentially sounded the alarm a bit for us. So we immediately kind of responded, and I embedded with that team and started making some contingency plans and kind of figuring out what our next steps were going to be. And we had some of this planning, of course, done, as everybody will recall. You know, when it went into a little bit of a dormant status, we went back to a little bit of our normal operations, but ramped back up by calling in some more staff members and being able to deal with that and being at the briefings and doing some of that planning. So it definitely was a very late night, I will say that, and trying to get up to speed, which is fairly routine for us, is generally our model is something happens no matter what it is or what kind of emergency, and there's always a little bit of gap time as we get ramped up, just like it takes time to get that team here. So it's been, I don't have too many more specifics, I'll be real honest, it's been a very long couple weeks, and I don't know if I remember everything that exactly went down that night, but that's how that's generally how it went down.
Sure, sure. Dan Nelson with the Borough's Office of Emergency Management. Thanks so much for joining us. I know you got to catch a flight down to the South Peninsula. Thanks.
Appreciate that. I think it has landed, so I will say goodbye, and thank you so much for having me on.
Okay, bye-bye. Dan Nelson there. He's his office has done a good job, don't you think?
I think they did a great job, yes. With their Borough blog, I think it's the one significant focal point for current up-to-date fire information. Not only fire, but it covers the other things with the traffic movement. The Alaska State Troopers are involved with it.
Schools.
The schools, everything. And I take my hat off to the borough officials who put the program together, and they've been sticking with it. The call center has also done a fantastic job providing info, providing leadership as to where to get other info, and they were up front. If they didn't know, they would say they didn't know, and they would try to track it down and get back to people. The call center is still open, 8 to 4:30, and you can get a hold of them by 262-4636 is their phone number. And the blog is still up and operational, and that's kpboem.com.
.blogspot.com.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a terrific, terrific website. Brian, let me ask you about the staffing. There's more firefighters on the fire right now than there were in July when it was first real big. What teams do we have, and what are they doing where?
Well, we've got, like I mentioned, 719 personnel today at this point. That includes 20 hand crews, generally about 20 people each, from all over. Of course, we try to get as local crews as we can because of timing and getting them to the site to get the work done. The majority of them are from this area, but we get them where we can. We've got seven helicopters affiliated with the incident, and they all come with their assorted staffing as well. We've got 24 engines, and again, as far as getting equipment here quickly, we want to use those resources that are the closest. And those engines can come with anywhere from two to maybe four individuals each. We've got two dozers that are available to the incident if we need them. They have been used in prior days, but not much within the last 5 days probably. So they are engaged so that we can get quickly through an area and then build off of that dozer line to improve and deepen that black area along a perimeter, so that if we're working direct against a fire, right on the fire line, that's preferred as far as losing additional acres, but it also adds a safety concern with firefighters near the fire. So we sometimes we'll build a line, an indirect line, out and away from the fire, and then we can shore up that dozer line or hand line with additional fire placed so that we can strengthen that line. So that's a lot of our personnel there. Of course, we also have aerial resources other than the helicopters. And, you know, as of late with the weather conditions that we've seen, you know, we'll struggle with aircraft if it's cloudy, low clouds, or if there's a high level of smoke. While the clouds and smoke dissipate some of the fire activity, it's a double-edged sword in that it doesn't allow our aircraft to fly. So what's good for one thing is maybe not so good for another.
Oh, sure, sure. You know, I saw on your guys' website a picture of that little one-person helicopter with the two rotors. And that's just the coolest little thing. I want one of those now.
Just, yeah, that would be fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just take it to work 3 miles away. Let's see. And a portion of the Upper Kenai River is open again now. Is that right? The from Cooper Landing to Jim's Landing, is that right? Or
it's open limited to 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. starting today, and it runs from Cooper Landing to Sportsman's Landing.
Sportsman's, okay. And then the lower river below that is still closed.
Yeah, all other closures are still in effect, including the Russian River and the Russian River Campground.
Oh, okay. What's the situation on the ground in those places? Is the fire still threatening, or is it just still being worked on for protection?
No, most of the threat there is just keeping people safe and away from any fire activity. It's not imminent that flame front will get there. It's just we've wanted to keep those areas available for fire traffic so that they could respond quickly.
Oh, sure, sure. Andy, earlier you said you were going to, you had a official weather forecast outlook. What are things looking like for the rest of the week and the weekend here?
Yes, you know, you hit it right on the nail on the head with your forecast that you issued. A very small discussion in today's National Weather Service for the Central Peninsula. It says a few lingering showers today will give way to a drying trend for the second half of the week. So for today, we're looking at cloudy skies, relative humidity maybe as high as 56%, southwest winds 4 to 9. For tonight, we're looking at mostly clear. 40s temperature and good relative humidity recovery up to possibly 94%. With a southwest wind still in place, maybe up to 8 miles an hour. And then for Thursday, mostly clear, but they're calling for the possibility of showers. 67 for a high and a relative humidity of a minimum of 45%. With light and variable winds. And then Friday through Saturday and Sunday, we're looking at mostly cloudy, patchy fog, possibly a chance of rain on Saturday, and then again a chance of rain on Sunday. The winds will be light and variable, maybe as high as 5 miles an hour from the east. So the weather is not real wet, but it is damp and cool, yeah. And that's all assists in the fire.
You mentioned humidity recovery. I know it goes down during the day as it heats up, and it goes up during the night. Where is the humidity coming from at night? Is it respiration from plants and such, or is it from the air cooling down and more moisture in it?
Mostly from the air cooling down, and it builds up a little bit of moisture, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was just a little confused there. I thought I remembered something about moisture and air from ground school.
Yeah, yeah. They call it dew point also.
The dew point.
Yeah.
Of course.
Dew point is equal to the temperature. It's zero visibility.
Yes, it is.
Fog.
I remember that now. You know, you're talking about keeping people safe, like on the Russian River areas and keeping folks away. Before we went on the air, we were talking about how deep this fire has been moving into the Duff and how long it's been since these areas have burned. I mean, by my calculations, like 72 years or something. So it's very deep. And I heard something yesterday, listening to the meeting last night, a thing called ash pits, which I didn't even know were a thing. Could somebody explain that to me? What is an ash pit?
Well, it pardon me. It's where a tree stood and the trunk and root system has burned out from under it. And the ash stays pretty much suspended at that point, very, very light and fluffy. And it's generally a very light in color, very light gray. But it's a concern for firefighters walking through those areas, especially if they're doing some scouting, gridding for doing some of that work. And it's a very concerning for them because they can easily overlook that color, fine color change, and step down into a hole as deep as their knees oftentimes. And so, and with ash staying burning down there, it's extremely hot and very dangerous.
Oh, man. I had no idea. So it's like the ash on the end of a cigar?
Yeah.
It's just like holding there?
It's just very light, and it just stays held up in that soil. But it's just like fluffy, I don't know, Cool Whip, if you will.
Huh.
You step in it and you'll go down deeply and can get severe burns.
Wow. And this is a function of deep fires that burn roots and everything?
Exactly. I mean, it can run along the surface of the ground and burn a tree. It burns those subsurface materials of the tree and the root and the trunk out. And it's left there as a fluff, if you will.
You know, I guess I've never walked in a forest after it's burned, but driving past them, you know, I usually just see these black spikes sticking out of the ground thinking, well, that's a forest fire there. But sometimes it could be something you don't see went through there or used to be a tree there.
Absolutely. And we've taken a couple of media on tours along the fire line, but we really don't want to get them walking into the black. On an occasion when you have to do that, generally they're instructed to step in my steps so that you're clear of any ash pits.
Yeah. Wow. How deep is this is this Duff layer? I keep hearing that it's feet thick, just debris from decades of what is it made out of anyway? Don't these things rot after some point?
They do. The Duff layer can range from a couple of inches to several feet deep. It's organic material. In Alaska, we have tundra, and then we have tussocks. Okay, the tussocks are those polygon shapes that are very hard to walk around. You can't jump them. And then you have the tundra, which is mostly the situation with the Swan Lake fire environment, along with the black spruce and some mixed hardwoods. We're in a drought condition, very, very dry conditions. We've gotten less than half the normal rainfall since early spring. Consequently, the Duff layer, that's the layer just below the surface of the green vegetation, is very, very dry. And as drying continues, that is organic material. It's old blueberries, bushes, green vegetation that is over the years has built up on the surface of the ground. It's kind of like a natural composting pile, if you will. So that stuff gets very, very dry, and once it's exposed to some extreme heat that the Swan Lake fire generated, it will stay burning, and it could burn for a long period of time.
Wow. You know, I've seen, we talked about it before we went on the air, too. I've seen, like, slash piles survive the winter,
That's
underneath the snow and everything. Mm-hmm. Any chance of this happening? Any spots next spring showing up? We see some fumaroles of smoke tendrils?
You can bet on it, yes.
Huh? Wow.
Mostly along, perhaps, the most likely places will be along stream beds, river beds, where the bank is curved over and you have a 3 or 4 foot drop to the water's edge. Back underneath that bank could hold fire for an extended period of time. It is also sheltered from any moisture, wind, rain, snow. So the chances of it being more hydrated is considerably less than out on the flat terrain.
Wow. In relation to the ash pits, I think I heard this last night on the meeting, but did I hear that some firefighters were injured stepping into ash pits on this fire?
Yes, they have. Now, the extent of those injuries, I can't comment to, but yes, that we've had some injuries with that.
Okay. Nobody died?
No, no.
Okay.
No.
Nobody's crippled?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay.
No.
Oh, good. I know you can't say anything, HIPAA and all that, but, I just want to make sure people out there know that it was a horrible
yeah, no,
tragedy.
No, and it's been more than one incident, but generally they are observed and most frequently later that same day returned to their workstation.
How, there have been some very high-profile tragedies on wildfires around the nation, and then also overseas. I think it was either Greece or Turkey a couple of years ago, and then in Spain, I think last year, wildfires killing hundreds of people in their cars as they're trying to get away. Where am I going with this? It seems to me that the mission of everybody's safety, kind of starts with keeping people away from the fire, right? How successful have we been?
Well, I think we've been extremely successful in the time I've been here. And, Andy can maybe chime in on that too. But I know a couple of instances where we've seen some videos from the public of some pretty high fire activity along the roads. And we work really hard with all of our partners, especially the Alaska State Troopers, to manage that risk. A particular day in mind, we had a much reduced fire activity and opened the highway with the pilot cars. And then shortly after, we got a wind event that then rapidly increased the fire activity. Of course, we were in the middle of a particular pilot car going through, taking visitors and citizens through, and we had to then quickly clear that highway. Once we did that, then the highway was closed again for a period of time until the fire danger really reduced then later.
Mm-hmm. I had a friend who's a couple of friends actually have been in different lines going through, and by and large, actually universally, they have nothing negative to say about even sitting in line. Because it all seems to be pretty well organized and pretty well communicated. And I think that's really the thing probably explains why you guys are so awesome at your job, and your job is so well represented in incident command, is that people like to know what's going on, right?
It's imperative that we keep the public in tune to what is going on. It takes an awful lot of coordination between the fire teams, the area resources that are utilized, and I'm talking about the people in the front office that take care of timesheets. They receive a huge number of phone calls from the public. It's not only the public information officers' phones ringing. It's the support end of everything. And people want to know, can I drive the highway? So that information needs to get disseminated through the media contacts that are maintained with the team, the contacts maintained from area offices like the Division of Forestry office in Soldotna. That same information is dispersed amongst the VFDs, Central Emergency Services. It also goes to the radio stations, the newscasts, television stations, the trooper's office, and it's a sharing of information, and the troopers generate information for us, we generate it for them. It's an exchange of information and a highly coordinated effort. And if there's one thing that happens and the level of links are disturbed, that information flows quits, and then we got to fix it. And oftentimes it takes a lot of modification and tweaking the system to make it work. The public is very good at pointing out where we do not do well. And so that is the best indicator of what we need to work on. And I think the borough over the years has done a wonderful job, as well as the Division of Forestry and the BLM and the Forest Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the list goes on.
Brian, let me ask you about other technology. I saw a picture also, besides the super cool helicopter, of like a big drone, not like one of the little ones I have, but someone's got like 8 engines on it.
Yeah, we're using technology more and more every year as we can, and it becomes available. Now, we do tell the citizens not to use drones, because we have a plan with our aerial operations that a citizen drone could get in the way and cause significant damage or injury to our firefighters. So we want to discourage and say no drones. Basically, if they're flying, we can't. But we are using more and more drones within the fire incident management team, especially on this incident where we're concerned about the ash pits that we talked about earlier, and placing firefighters in those areas along the line when they're doing their regular mop-up activities. Generally, they line out in a grid form, a walk through the portion of the line that's been prepared ahead of them. They're feeling on the ground for hot spots. Well, we don't want them stepping into those ash pits. So with firefighter safety in mind, we are using these drones that can identify the hot spots and pinpoint firefighters to go to that specific location and to douse that fire or that hot spot or that heat signature that's under the ground.
Really?
And so we're using the technology to keep our firefighters safer, and then they're also a lot more efficient, so they can cover more ground quickly that way.
So you've got infrared on your drone?
We do.
That's wild. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, we've got the technology now. Who gets to drive the drone? Is that you?
No.
No?
I have taken some training, and I probably could do not very well at it. But, no, they have to be certified pilots, drone operators, for that.
Wow. As we wait for the fall rains to come, what can people do, to help out and keep things copacetic between now and the time the wedding rain comes here in the fall?
Well, from my perspective, and I've talked with our structural firefighting group, they're working, of course, in Cooper Landing, helping the homeowners to do some firewise work around their homes. They wanted to commend the citizens of that area. Many of them have done their own ahead of time, and that's made it a lot quicker and safer for our firefighters, and then our firefighters can go and concentrate on the areas that need more assistance. So I need to commend those citizens for taking that step on their own.
Oh yeah, what's the main takeaway for preparing your home? Defensible space, keeping wood piles from not being next to your house, chopping down trees.
Well, you want to limb the trees up as far as you could reach safely. You want to have a spacing 6, 8, 10 feet in between those trees. You want to maintain at least 1.5 times distance the height of the tree from your structures, okay? So you need that clearing there. That makes it easier for a fire group of people to come in and help protect that ground. You don't want flammable shrubs growing next to the house. Move the lilac bush away from the house. That could be a major help in protecting your own property.
Wow. I was watching a show about fires, and they're talking about metal roofs and how, you know, they're good for the sparks. But that they have one flaw, is that the underneath of the sheets, they're corrugated, that if you don't block those, embers can fly up underneath there and get your sub roof.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. They make a flashing. I'm not too sure about the building terminology, but you got a metal roof. You should put that same metal material underneath the eave that butts up against the side of the house. It's not called metal roofing.
Yeah.
Mine is, it has perforated with holes because I have a cold roof and the air circulates, but it is more fireproof than not having anything there at all.
Yeah.
There are also vents that take air up into the attic that keep the humidity and et cetera out of your home. It would be advisable to close those vents as well, because if it's sucking air, it's sucking embers.
Oh, yeah.
So you need to be careful of that. Also need to consider where you're storing your firewood. It should not be next to your home. It makes some sense. You just put it out and away, as was alluded to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And you should remove your propane tanks if they're leaning up against the house, or you got a barbecuer. Usually it's on somebody's deck. I mean, that's just all normal things. At least take the propane bottle off of the barbecue and move it away from your building. If you have your lawnmower right by the side of the house, move it. It has gasoline in it. Take your gasoline storage and move those cans of fuel away from the home. If you have hoses with nozzles, make sure they're workable so you could do some firefighting on your own part around your home. Yes.
Mm-hmm. What, at what point, this might not be a question to ask with 4 minutes to go, but at what point how much can a homeowner do, you know, with a hose in their own yard? You know, say there's a ready, set, go, and they're on go, and, you know, should they always go, or do they have a chance of saving their place?
Well, prior to that fire front coming, prior to any evacuation notices, they can be preparing their property to be defensible. They can water their lawn significantly prior so that any embers that do fall don't hit receptive fuels. In fact, that's a lot of what our firefighters are doing, is helping those homeowners established sprinkler systems around their property so that that will happen. And we've seen a number of cases where fire is approaching and has come up to a wetted soil or wetted duff in a cabin example, and the fire has just gone out right there. So that's important to prepare for in the event something comes prior to you having to leave.
You know what just occurred to me is wetting the ground. I mean, we've been talking about dry duff and everything, but wetting the ground would help a lot, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Man. You know, the, I've always believed that if it's July on the Central Peninsula, it's raining. We had 3 days of rain in July. The other truism about the weather here, Brian, is that in September, we get storms. South from the south with a lot of rain. I saw a weather map yesterday, and it did not look promising. There's a front moving by, but a lot of high pressure on that map. Yeah. I'm not optimistic about getting a typhoon in here in the next week or two.
Recognizing the conditions currently, the state extended the fire season until the end of September, which requires people to utilize the burn permit system through the month of September. The burn restriction and closure has been lifted effective this morning, so you could have your campfires and whatnot. But again, people need to pay attention and treat their fire with respect, and do not leave an unattended campfire. Please utilize it, enjoy it, but please put it out after you're done.
Absolutely. What does the extension of the fire season here in Alaska with the thousands of firefighters that are here now mean for staffing of fires in the lower 48, where it's kind of gearing up at this point?
Normally, the lower 48 is only at a national level of 2 preparedness. Not preparedness, but it's level 2. That indicates a very small, maybe moderate amount of fire activity collectively throughout the lower 48 states.
Right.
So that is one reason why we are able to have the number of people we have up here. We have 43 crews in the state right now.
Wow.
We have 57 engines employed right now. We have 14 helicopters, not to mention an assembly of fixed wings, dozers. There's 1,549 people on fire in Alaska right now.
Yeah.
So lower 48's not real busy. We are fortunate for that. We're getting a lot of help from lower 48 resources.
Yeah. But isn't this the time when lower 48 fires really kick up? And
yes.
the fires in California were like October and November.
Yes.
So
It is the time they usually get busy in the lower 48 and the southern part of Canada as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming in today. Talking about the Swan Lake fire. We didn't get to talk much about the North Fork and Caribou Lake fire, but I will take care of that in the newscast later. Thank you, Brian Scott, with the Great Basin Type 1 team, and Andy Alexandru from the Alaska Division of Forestry, and also Dan Nelson, who joined us earlier. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jay.
You've been listening to a broadcast of the Kenai Conversation from Wednesday, September 4th. Keep that in mind when considering any dated references in the show.
Kick back and reminisce each Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. with Sal Cassano as she features the artists and their music of yesteryear. Learn fun facts about all your favorite dead musicians right here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Salgatna.